Well, hey there.
Hi there. I'm delighted to be here today with Brantley Vossler, who is host of the Transposition podcast. That's something new in your life, Brantley. Would you like to talk a bit about how you got started with that?
Man, that is weird to hear someone say it just started yesterday. Yeah, that's very
Well,
much
this is
a,
good news because when I was on X, I did a search for transposition, and you were like the on X, you were the third thing that came up under transposition.
Oh
Your
wow, that's
message
actually
got transposition podcast.
that's maybe too much pressure for me. I gotta really live up to that. That is one of my fears with it actually is living up to it, living into it. It's a so yeah, this idea started actually somewhat through talking to you, through talking to Drew Miniker, who some of your viewers will know, and Christian Baxter. And yeah, so there's a Lewis, a C.S. Lewis sermon actually called Transposition, and I just love it, and I want to talk to people about it, and really a bunch of other things. It's been fun getting the chance to talk to people in so-called this little corner, and so that's how the name came to be. But I am, I'm quite nervous about, yeah, that living into it thing, even though I very much love it, it's continuing to bloom for me the more I engage with it and the more that I converse with people about it. But I will be honest, I'm no expert. And so I don't want to set myself up as like, the transposition expert. It's more
Well,
just like,
I think
oh, I love it.
what you'll find, and this has been kind of fascinating for me since I started thinking about the idea, is that just like for me on my channel, I'm pursuing a certain idea about the process of art making. And the longer that I've pursued it, the more I see that it's a very central aspect of reality.
Yeah.
And everything kind of simplifies down to that. And then when I start thinking about transposition, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It once you start really exploring it, you find it everywhere, and then you see it's a way in which almost everything can be simplified into
Right.
a deep data compression kind of idea that expands out into the cosmos.
I
So
know.
the more you talk to people, the more you will find that just arising naturally. So I don't think you have to be an expert on transposition. It's just a part of your daily life.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of saying it. It's a it is, one way to say it is like it's partly how reality unfolds or reveals itself. And so it's happening all over the place and all of the time. And so, it almost I think I even joked in a thread you were in on X that I'm gonna take this idea way too far. I don't know if you remember that, but I just started seeing it everywhere and in everything. And I can see now, I can see some places that it has some more definition, and some ways I'm misunderstanding it as well, or I'm, I still have definitely deep questions about it, and I'm wanting to explore it, and how it works, and also just I think help others grapple with it as well, because it's this huge thing. And so yeah, it'll be an adventure. That's what it will be. But yeah, I'm wanting to be careful with that, the host of the Transposition podcast. That
That's
does
what you
not
are.
yeah, I guess that is what I am now.
Do
But
you have a working definition of transposition that you're operating under? We can share
Oh
working
man.
definitions.
Oh, great question. I should be good at answering this. Yeah, so do you mind, so I'll share a really simple one, and then maybe I can also kind of start to summarize and give some examples, and then we can just kind of go from there. Does that sound all right?
Sure.
So transposition is the process by which a higher reality gets reduced into something lower. Okay, how, Just that. How does that sound? That's a very simple way of explaining it, but something complex and with tons of multiplicity gets reduced down into a unity. That might be another way to say it. There's a reduction that's happening, and yet it still is containing something of the higher. So maybe one of the best examples is a seed. A tree drops a seed from above, and a whole new tree is contained in that seed, but it's also reduced. And so there's so many things that are like that in the C.S. Lewis essay. So in our last conversation, I mentioned this, but I'm a worship pastor, and so music is something that very much connects with me. So in the C.S. Lewis sermon, actually, the transposition is partly a musical analogy. So as I've talked with Drew, many many musicians will have some quibbles with this definition of transposition. Because it's not exact, it's partly rearranging. It doesn't map on completely to music as a one for one, but in the sermon, we'll give Lewis his due, and what he does is he shows that a whole symphony can be reduced down to a piano piece. And it contains something of the whole symphony. He uses the example of flutes. When the flutes show up on the piano, they have, the range is intentional, that they're in the flute range if they're playing a flute part. And so, yes, it's a reduction, but it's also containing something of the whole orchestra. So yeah, how did I do just there?
Yeah, and I when I was thinking about it this morning, I sprang one level up from that. So I really like using seed as an example because seed has it is a whole and yet it's filled with multiplicity. And the tree is a whole and yet it's filled with multiplicity. And so it's both the whole bringing another whole into existence, but at a new level, right? And it's also a multiplicity uniting into a oneness, but then that oneness breaks out into the multiplicity again. And it's also a one bearing a multiplicity of seeds. And so it works both ways, right? So as you were giving the description of a transposition in music, like from a symphony down to a piano, I also thought about this urban legend about Mozart, who supposedly would get a symphony complete in his mind at one instant.
Yeah, I need to read
Okay.
about I need to read about this
Well, I mean, it's
more,
something
but
that
it's fascinating.
it's something Wolfgang Smith told me. Whether he's right or not, I don't know, but he lived a long time and he was a very brilliant man, so and very well read, so he may have read it someplace. But let's say it's true.
We'll trust him. Yep.
I can kind of imagine it because a painting is kind of like that. You'll get an idea. Maybe you can't see all the edges of it yet, but it's an idea. It's complete. Okay, so Mozart gets this complete idea. Now, in order to transpose that idea into the world, in order to make that idea accessible to other people, this wholeness that is more than can be contained in this instant is going to require time and energy and matter to unpack. And that unpacking process is going to require that the transcendent whole that is there to begin with is going to have to be broken down into parts, none of which can contain the whole, and yet each of which is essential to represent the whole when it comes back together again. And so you have this magnificent whole funneling down through the mind of Mozart out into the world through time and energy and matter as he writes the flute part and the cello part and the violin part and the piano part and all of these things, breaking it down into all these parts. And then at the end, all and then the musicians have their sheet music, and then they are participating in this. Okay, so the whole is too much. It's the higher coming into the lower, and the only way that that higher thing can be expressed is through this lower participation altogether, and not only the participation of the musicians and the music coming together to recreate the symphony, but the participation between the symphony as it is performed and the audience that is listening. So the only way that the whole can be contained is in this space, this relationship between the listener and the accomplished symphony. Then the intensity and the transcendence of the whole can begin to be instantiated in the world. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, that's great. And I love that too, that participation piece I think is so key because when you first give that idea that that symphony was came in a flash to Mozart, and then it needed to be worked out and written through time and matter and space and energy. There's part of us, I think, that goes, well, that's the boring part. That's so unsatisfying because it was already there. Why not just receive it's all complete, and so why not just receive it? And yet it's also do you know what I mean? How kind of there's a moment where it's like, oh, that's so unsatisfactory. Now I have to just write out all the notes, and like how boring to just piece it all out and just by sweat. And then when it was already there in the first place, there's something unsatisfying in that. But then when you add, oh, this allows for a whole symphony of people to participate and to become one thing for a moment in time, then it seems all totally worth it. And I'll put in all the sweat, all the effort to make that wondrous moment happen. And so, yes, I love that you talked about that participation part of
Well,
it
and
because.
then all of these people who have participated in the creation of this thing also get to share with all the people who are listening, right? And so it goes out like that. And in a seed, in a way, does the same thing, because the seed grows a new tree that then lets out more seeds, and so you get this multiplication effect. But it's always the higher moving down into the lower. It's always the higher moving down into the lower. I mean, the reductionist scientists always want to talk about emergence, that everything just starts from the bottom and somehow works its way up to the top. But there's always this higher to the lower thing going on.
Yeah, and I'm the last time we spoke, you mentioned something about John Vervaeke. I can't remember what it was, but I know enough that his word for the top down thing is emanation, and that resonates so deeply with me. And in Wolfgang Smith, did he have a term for that higher moving into?
Vertical causation.
Yeah, vertical causation. Yeah, all these things seem to resonate at a similar level. They're after that, yeah, that grand mystery of the higher coming into the lower. How does that happen? One of the things I really appreciated with if I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but with Wolfgang Smith, with that vertical causation idea, there was some amount of mystery. The unsatisfying thing was that if someone wanted to be completely empirical about it, his system would not offer a completely empirical way of testing this theory. And I'm always like, that makes it a good theory to some extent. You know, that there is a that there it contains some mystery to say, how does this happen exactly, and how do we measure it, and how do we show it, or how do we prove it? And of course, yeah, as a Christian, I love that, because well, we can say, wow, look at God. He's moving, he's acting, he's holding the worlds in his hands, sometimes we say. There's all those things like that, where we can give God credit and glory at all these moments, at all these levels, when when he's acting at so many levels. It just makes me, it really does make me worship that he could be working in all these things. I know there's kind of a lot of interesting discussions about God of the Gaps theories here. I actually don't know a ton about that. But I
Well, I
know
mean, the
that's.
whole God of the Gaps idea is just that whenever something shows up that we can't figure out yet in the scientific universe, there are some people who will want to say, okay, well, then it must be God. And if later on the scientists figure out that gap, then God disappears because that was where God was. But John Lennox always likes to say, and I think he gets this from C.S. Lewis, and of course it's quite obvious if you're reading the Bible that God is not in the gaps. God is the whole thing. Right? So all the gaps exist in God as well as all of the yet to be known, all of that is part of God's beautiful creation. But the vertical causation thing, the reason that Wolfgang came to that conclusion was that he was exploring what's called the measurement problem in the world of physics. And that is that there was this great quandary when they first came up with the whole idea of quantum mechanics that particle is simultaneously, well, the particle is not a thing, it's a field of possibilities. So until you measure it, you don't know exactly where it is. Once you measure it, then you know where it is. But now the field of possibilities has been reduced from a field of possibilities to a point. So they talk about it either being a wave or a particle. But actually, it's both things at the same time. The particle is always there in the wave, somewhere in the wave, but until you measure it, you can't know. But the problem is with the measuring that you can't measure it at the same in the same domain of reality that it exists. You need something a level up. You need to measure it with machinery. You need to measure it with some sort of equipment, or you need to measure it with some sort of observation. And so Wolfgang came up with this idea that that is a kind of vertical causation, that when you move this level up, and that it is the observation or the measurement that takes place at that moment that actually affects the causation. And anyway, that's kind of the backstory of it. But then he came up with this beautiful image of the instantaneous vertical causation, which comes down, which is kind of the point, and then the circle is the perimeter of the circle is the world in which we exist. And then the center of the circle, all the rest of the substance of the circle is the spiritual reality. And so he came up with this whole cosmology based on that, which I think it's interesting. I don't, it doesn't really land for me, but I understand why he went through that process with the vertical causation. But let me show you a scripture that I think illustrates this higher to lower in a very concise way, and that is 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. For he said, meaning God, my grace is sufficient for you, For my power is made perfect in weakness. My power is made perfect
Yes,
in weakness, right?
totally.
And so then Paul's response to that is, I will boast all the more loudly in my weakness, all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest on me.
Yes.
So this
Oh, that's
transposition
amazing.
can only take place if there's a like a willing receiver,
Yeah,
right?
right. Right.
And there's so many. Here's a quote from Lewis's essay. He
Well,
says,
while you're looking for that, this is just beautifully serendipitous, but my church at this moment is we're in 2 Corinthians. We've been in 2 Corinthians for months, and we, you know, as a Protestant church does, we gave gave the sermon series a name, and that name is Power in Weakness. So we've been
Wow.
that's where we've been. That's how, you know, as we've, you know, as our pastor looked at 2 Corinthians and looked at that, you know, the theme of it, and you know, we always try to, if we can summarize or show like a core thing about it, even though there's a lot there. And so yeah, that was what he chose. And yeah, that power and weakness theme in 2 Corinthians is all over the place. Well, it's also all over scripture. But yeah, so anyway, that's just a little bit of lovely coincidence there.
No kidding, because I just saw that verse this morning. So it's crazy.
Wonderful.
I had the opportunity to attend the Sing Conference in Nashville last fall.
Yeah, we talked about that a little.
Yeah, and they gave us this little sample. They're working on building a new hymnal,
Yeah.
new hymns for the church along with old hymns.
Yep,
And
I
they
have
gave
that
us this
copy
little
on my
sample.
desk.
Yeah. And so this morning for my devotions, I was singing through this lovely hymn, Yet Not I, But Through Christ in Me, and which is a great hymn.
Yeah.
And at the end for the devotional, there's two verses, Galatians 2:20, which is another great transposition verse. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. I've also heard it, I live by the faith of the Son of God, which I kind of like,
Interesting.
who
Yeah,
loved
wow.
me and gave himself for me. And so I read those two verses and I started thinking, God demonstrated his love for us in this, that while we were yet sinners, while we were yet insufficient, while we were yet not capable of holding this
Yeah.
higher into the lower, while we were yet sinners, he died for us. So that made me think about love and how really creation is a transposition of love, that
Yeah.
God's love is too much.
Totally.
And even the entire cosmos is insufficient to hold the magnitude of God's love. So anyway, you're my guest. I'm talking too much.
No, that's wonderful. Another verse that came to mind for me was and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. There's a lot here with acknowledging telos, that there's a, you know, an intelligence that calls something upward to that. You know, that's what's happening with the seed, right? It is being reduced, but then it's called according to the purposes of that which is above. And so it comes down, but then it gets called up back into what, not just nothing, but it gets called up back into something with telos, something with purpose. And so yes, while we were dead in our trespasses, but then we are made alive to live not just now live again how you want, but no,
Mm-hmm.
live again according to his purposes, his calling. He's the higher one with the power and the glory and the kingdom that wants to be shown off, and you get to participate in that. There's that participation piece again. You have the opportunity to now live into that. And man, what a wonderful thing. I
We are
wanted.
rooted, we are simultaneously rooted and grounded in him, rooted and grounded in him, and then called according to his purpose. Yeah,
Yeah.
like that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. So there's one example. If people are still with us in this, if we haven't lost them, I've been wanting to give a to find ways to kind of really simplify and bring this down to some really, actually the physics examples are man, way above my head. I can kind of wrap my, but I am not a physics person by any means. But I'm trying to make this easily digestible with my worship team. I've done a couple of devotionals for them based on transposition, and so yeah, I've been trying to find ways to talk about it. The symphony is a very clear example, but I wanted to share another one with you, and there's a question that comes up for me at the end that I wonder what you might think about it. But have you seen the show on Apple TV called Silo?
Oh yes, I love that
You
show.
have seen it? Okay, great.
Every
Okay.
episode, some of them more than once. Yeah.
Oh, wow, interesting.
Yeah,
Okay,
it's an
you're the first
amazing
person.
symbolic picture. Amazing. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Oh, wonderful. You're the first person that I've asked this and they've said yes. So my wife and I, we watched it. We just finished a couple weeks ago. And
I haven't finished the second season yet because it's pretty dark and I can't watch dark things like that by myself. And my husband bailed on me about halfway through season two.
you gotta get him back.
Okay.
So I'll summarize just for those that haven't seen it. It's a very simple concept and problem. There's not really many spoilers here, but the show is called Silo, and it's basically about a post-apocalyptic world where people are living underground in these silos, and they don't exactly know why they are down in the dark. They don't know what happened above. It was a long time ago. I was seeing so much resonance with the with a fall. There was a fall as a type of apocalypse, and they don't know exactly how. People argued about it, and just same as we argue about Genesis, probably in some ways. But anyway, that's kind of all you need to know for this example. But something that they do so brilliantly in that show, and it probably made me cry. I mean, I don't know, three or four times, but they have those relics that show up. And so relics in the show, they're left over from pre-apocalypse world. And a character will encounter one of these relics. And one of my favorites, I think you've probably seen this part before, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it's in season one. But the someone will open up a magazine that is, left over from our world, and there will be, and it's a kitschy magazine too. It's not beautifully made, and there's a bad font on it, and I don't even, it's like an ad for a vacation or something like that. And in the background, there's a image of a beach, and it's so powerful the way it's done. One of these characters who's never seen a beach, there you see them encounter the image of a beach, and their heart is just like lit on fire. And it's so captivating to me. So it and one of the main things in Lewis's sermon was he says something like, this is a very good explanation for grounding the Christian conception of hope. And in that moment, there's something so hopeful to that person that like they that a beach, a real beach existed, and they're just filled with this hope. But that little image is a transposition of something so real and so grand that they really could not even imagine it as a you know a silo dweller. But they encounter this little taste of it, and man, I just love those moments where they're lit on fire and they realize, oh my goodness, like there's a real world out there, and it's realer than real, and it's more beautiful than I ever could have imagined. And so, you know, there's something too with the Lord's Prayer where something of heaven is brought down. His will is done on earth. And you know, that's a transposition as well. And so anyway, I one of the things that I wonder what you might think about is, oh man, I lost my train of thought. I got okay, let me stop there actually. I'll remember it in a second. But do you see that simple way of explaining, you know, those little images as
I just think what
transpositions?
you did is there is just so beautiful. I had when I saw that episode, I had a little glimmer of that, but not as full and beautiful pictures you just represented. But what occurred to me when I saw that, I was thinking much more practical sense, is the powers that be have done everything they can to make those relics disappear
Yeah,
and to
wow.
prevent people from seeing them, because they don't want anybody to know what there was before. They don't want anybody to have any sort of hope about what there was before, because they don't want anybody leaving.
Yeah.
And you don't quite know why
Yeah.
they don't want anybody leaving. That's part of the mystery of the show, right?
Yeah.
But it's so much like, in some ways, it's so much like 1984 that way, that they have their whole system worked out, and you can't let these little glimpses break through into their system, or it's going to create
Right.
havoc and chaos, right?
Right. Yeah, okay. So this is what I've been thinking about. It kind of came back to me, but so when someone encounters one of these things, they something that's kind of implicit in it is that so they've never seen a beach before. They don't know the meaning of it. They don't know the vast of it. They literally have never seen it before. But what I love about this is it seems like they were made to understand the beach. I can't, that's something that we kind of know as people who have seen the real beach and seen how beautiful it is. We kind of know I was made to delight in this. In this beach, like I was actually, yeah, I was made that way. And so, like with the symphony example, it's almost like we were, and this is what I'm trying to figure out how to explain better, but we were made to hear a symphony that we've never seen. Okay, actually, you know who says it the best? C.S. Lewis, surprising. But he says, I always want to get this right. Let me just see. You know, I think I'll get it close enough for now. I've rattled this off enough times, but he says, if I find in myself a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is I was made for another world. And yeah, in that show, when that beach image comes through, it's like, this is the world you were made for. And you get to, that little moment where they delight in it and they long for it, they desire it. I think that is such a good image of Christian hope, that we are to long for the second coming of Christ, that we are to long for heaven, that we're to long for this consummation of these things that we don't understand, that we another verse I love to think about in this context is, we see in a mirror dimly. We can't see this full symphony, we can't hear this full symphony, but yet we were created for it. We were created for this world. But yeah, I wonder how that hits you.
Well, the thought that's going through my mind right now, like a mind worm, is, oh my gosh, you and I should do a podcast together, walking through the silo episodes one by one and looking at the symbolism of them.
Oh,
Would that
interesting.
be fascinating or
Oh,
what?
that'd be fun.
I would
Yeah.
love to watch the whole thing again. I'd have a reason to do it then.
Yeah, I want to see
Because there's
where they're
so much
taking it.
there. Like even in the first episode, the very first episode, where the sheriff's wife, they have so much wanted to have a baby, and then this is part of the plot I wouldn't want to spoil for anybody, but they have so much wanted to have a baby, and in the silo, that this is, becomes obvious very quickly, they have a lottery, and only a certain number of people can have babies because otherwise they'll get overrun with people and there won't be enough resources to take care of everybody. The silo, I think, fits 10,000 people, and so that's their cap. And so they have to make people believe that there's hope that they can have a baby. They keep all the women on birth control, like IUDs, until their lottery number comes up, and then they t supposedly take out the IUD, and then they can have a baby. So that's her hope. And when that hope is removed from her, then her next hope is cat becomes catastrophic, not only for her but for the whole silo. But yeah, so the whole thing about the beauty of children and the beauty of the love of a man and a woman being consummated, and the transposition that happens when this greater reality comes down into an infant. When that hope is taken away from people, which is kind of what's happening in our world today, it's not so much even that people have that hope anymore, it's just that the desire to hope has been removed from people, right?
Yeah, that is such a key piece of it that I think is missing in that conversation. Yes, I love the pronatalist themes of the show, that they make the longing for it so real and vivid. But yes, that's something that's so missing from that discourse today, that love still must be the aim and the goal and the purpose itself. And children, they fall out of love. It begins with love, but then when a child comes into the world, and this is back to that participation piece, is they grow up, and how much love do they provide for your whole family? I mean, it's amazing to watch. I have two young kids, and to see my parents now, I could never offer my parents the amount of love back to me that they poured into me. I can tell them, like, wow, thanks for raising me, thanks for feeding me every day. I can say thank you to some extent, but I could never provide that back to them. But there's something so amazing to watch my parents become grandparents, and they receive something so joyous from my children. And it's just so clear that love itself is a higher goal than even just reproduction. but yet it does, it is what makes it happen. And make, like, if you can help people love in a lot of ways, it's not so much about, you know, solving our crisis, our you know, fertility crisis or something like that. Aiming at love is a way better thing to do in so many ways. It's so available and so it's just better all around to aim at love. This is another Lewis thing, but you know, he says aim at heaven and get earth thrown in, aim at earth and get neither. And that there's something like that with even with children. Aiming at heaven all the time. Even, you know, in the scriptures, the themes of these really hard themes of barrenness, all throughout the scriptures. And yet you'll find characters who reorient themselves. And this is not a prosperity gospel thing. Reorient yourself and then you'll have children. But there is something there. Sometimes children will happen, but our reorienting to heaven is the goal all along. And you know, even you know, and so yeah, we have to keep that high view, aiming at heaven, aiming at love itself, aiming at hope. That's where we need to set our sights, set our minds on things above.
While you were talking about that, it occurred to me that one of the ways that the enemy has been so successful is in this. You mentioned that the parent and the grandparent receive so much love from the children. They're expressing love through their care and service and resources that they provide for the child and everything. But the child, the love that the child expresses is like completely unconditional. It's this
Yeah.
beautiful, unconditional love.
Right.
But in the world today, the digital media is not showing images of a baby and how much love a baby provides for the family. They're showing images of kitty cats and puppy dogs and
Yeah.
giraffes, and they amplify and deify the beauty of animals, so that you're satisfied with being able to see, oh, isn't it sweet how kitty cats are so, smart. And so if they were showing as many pictures of babies so that women were getting, this feeling, oh, I want to have a baby, instead they amplify all the images of what it's like to have a career and to be known and to become famous and to get a big paycheck and to get lots of kudos at work, and they push that side of a woman, and then they satisfy all her mothering needs with cute little kitty cat pictures. I mean, it's a pretty good fake.
Yeah, it is a good trick. And yeah, it's clear there's just so much, the word really is propaganda, going on there. And it's very organized as well. But I do think, you know, by the same token, we have to be careful here. You know, even aiming at children, is aiming too low in some extent. The way that you know, this will be a spoiler. You know, the way that C.S. Lewis ends that Hideous Strength, you know, is with Jane and Mark in love itself. And yes, children, you know, come from that flow, from that, but yet, I think that's so right too, and something we need to be still careful of, that we're always, yeah, setting our minds on things above, but then when we receive something from above, it's proper to say thank you. You know, this child, this precious child, really so clearly did not come from me. You know, it's like it came from heaven. I actually like the, in some ways, the symbolism of a stork. Maybe it gets cheesy or something, but where did it come from? That's a way to explain to a kid, you know, babies come from heaven. I mean, what are we like? They, yes, we have some material causation ways that we could not describe here, but we, you know, but where do they really come from? They come from above. They're dropped off to us, and then we say thank you, and we, you know, we dedicate our children unto the Lord, and we give them back. But you know, I still am wanting to make sure we. If we are going to receive anything, we have to be looking, we have to be looking up. And you know, sometimes if we look up, we tend to be surprised by what we receive. If we look, you know, to the things of earth, it tends to be, well, my expectations need to be met. You know, I'm looking at something that I expect to receive, or I deserve, or I can grasp, or I can. But when we look up and receive something, you know, all we can do is say thank you. I did not deserve this. This is grace in my life. And yeah, I don't know. I think that's just important to for people to hear as well. Sometimes people receive things that they might expect, you know, like a child from a marriage. Sometimes it could be something else. Who knows exactly what it was, but if it comes from above and you're able to see it, that's the true grace that you that we're after in a sense, and not these material things that we expect.
That's a great reminder, and a great reminder also that the gratitude that we feel for our blessings, we have to recognize that a blessing doesn't look the way we expect a blessing to look. And your example of Mark and Jane is just so perfect because at the beginning of that book, you can't ever imagine that they're going to love, be able to love each other again.
Right.
She is off in this individualistic mindset and bored with the whole thing. And he's off in his career and completely, you know, dedicated to becoming part of the in crowd. And you just can't imagine that they could ever want anything to do with each other again. And then at the end, they're in love. Now, a lot of worldly stories would be like, oh, you know, this big sack of love just comes down from heaven and envelops them, and then they're transformed into these loving people. Well, what actually happens between the beginning and the end is chaotic and complex and painful and catastrophic, and it involves everything in the cosmos, okay, between the beginning and the end. But the end, so in a way, it's kind of the picture of the Bible. You have Adam and Eve in the beginning, and then you have the marriage in the garden at the end between Christ and his bride. And then in between is all this other stuff, all of which is a gift given to us to bring us back to the place where we can love one another, which means we have to start being thankful even for the catastrophes. And that's the really
Oh,
hard
that's great. Totally. Totally. Oh, that is the really hard part. It strikes me too, just thinking about that ending again. It strikes me that he doesn't show. He could actually go one step further, show them in love, and then show a child. You know, it strikes me that he ends it, and it's them in love, and that is the ending itself. And it isn't it striking too with Revelation that there's. You know, it turns into a song of praise. It's just that's so clear that love was really meant to be it, all along. It's the beginning and the end and the Alpha and Omega, and of course, yeah, what is God? Well, God is love. It's wonderful to think about.
Yeah, well, so now can I read this quote from Transposition?
Oh yeah, let's do it.
Yeah,
Yeah, I wondered
okay.
if you wanted to, I don't know if you wanted to get into Bulverism at all. I still have a little bit of
Oh, I
time if
do.
we ever want to get there, but go with this first and
So
then
how much
we'll
time
make.
do you have?
I have another half hour.
Okay, we're good then. Let's do this and then we'll do bulverism. And
Great.
I'll leave it to you to define bulverism because it's a little slippery.
Yeah.
Okay. Lewis is in this essay on transposition, and he's in some sense he's making the point that when the higher comes into the lower, it can only utilize what is available in the lower. So sometimes our emotions, we don't have the full spread of emotions. So the higher coming into the lower will sometimes use an emotion that might have been used for some other purpose in the lower level, but then the higher utilizes it as well, which a person could easily understand if you've ever been in a worship service and a worship song or scripture or something, or some part of the message just grips you and you find yourself sobbing and completely torn apart. And yet that is this higher joy coming into the lower, but it's making use of the same emotional mechanism
Yeah.
as comes from, grief and sorrow and all mingled together.
Yeah.
And so the higher coming into the lower. So then he goes on to say, where we tend to go wrong is in assuming that if there is to be a correspondence between two systems, it must be a one-for-one correspondence, that A in one system must be represented by A in the other, and so on. But the correspondence between emotion and sensation turns out not to be of that sort. And there never could be a correspondence of that sort where one system was really richer than the other. If the richer system is to be represented in the poorer at all, this can only be by giving each element in the poorer system more than one meaning. The transposition of the richer into the poorer must, so to speak, be algebraical and not arithmetical. Now, what this made me think about, if the richer is to be represented in the poorer, this can only be by giving each element in the poorer system more than one meaning. There's this book that has been on my mind for years called Speaker's Meaning by Owen Barfield. And it's not a very long book, but Barfield is kind of difficult to understand for me. So I've been pondering it a lot. And one of the points that he makes, which he relates back to a lot of the philosophy that was being talked about during the era that he and C.S. Lewis were in the Inklings together, is those philosophers were trying to figure out where language comes from. And was language simply a matter of animals evolving into human beings that then grunt and then start to vocalize, and then some creature makes a word, makes a vocalization for a rock, and then that becomes the word for rock. And then, over time, all these different things in the world get words, and then that words become a language. And so, like,
Yeah,
language emerging from the bottom up.
all bottom up. Yep.
And but Barfield, through a long and tortuous argument, comes to the conclusion that now today we can see that every word has both an inner meaning and an outer meaning. Every word has an inner meaning and an outer meaning. And you might think of the inner meaning being kind of like a symbolic meaning or a way in which that word can be used in more than one situation because it can act as an analogy or a symbol or a metaphor. But the word also has an outer meaning, which is strictly, it is what it is. A rock is a rock.
Yeah, literal.
Right. But in the Bible, a rock can also be Christ. A rock
Right.
can also be a weapon, I mean, a lot of things. But there is an inner meaning and an outer meaning. Barfield makes the point that it is not the outer meaning that comes first, it's the inner meaning that comes first. Every word has first an inner meaning before it has an outer meaning. Now, I think the implications of that are vast because the only way that every word can have an inner meaning first is if language came as a gift to us,
Yeah.
as a completed whole,
Right.
with these inner meanings complete as a part of this transposition from the higher into the lower, so that we would have the capacity to have a relationship with the higher.
Oh man, yeah, that's so interesting. That's similar. Yeah, that really helps me, 'cause I'm trying to grasp for something that helps explain the, yeah, how we were made, that we seem to have this ability that, you know, some of these desires that we have are foretastes of something so much more, and we long for things that we seemingly do not even know that we long for. And that must be connected to that as well, that, you know, as we learn, we grow into language, but we're also growing into, you know, desiring the right things, desiring the things of God that were pre-written on our hearts. Yeah, I'll have to think about that. I haven't made it yet to Barfield. That sounds really. I can also see how, because I wasn't sure how this related to the AI discussion, but now I think I can see with that a little more, because yeah, those large language models, they received, well, yeah, that they received their intelligence for a very bottom up process, right? You know, they seem to be able to capture it all, but yet even there, where are they getting it from? They're getting it from humans who already have language, and they might have received it from bottom up, but then the question is, where did we get language from? Where did our large language model come from? And it seems very difficult to explain that in a bottom up way purely. It seems like at some point you'll run out. But that, yeah, that inner meaning, that has to be it. There's something that seems so right about that to me.
Well, it seems like the LLMs are operating off of a data set which theoretically holds within it all of the accumulated human knowledge as it has been instantiated in language from the beginning of time. So that is not bottom up by any means. That's the whole banana.
Yeah.
Available, and then the LLM is capturing a thread here and there. And I've noticed just in the last few months that the LLM has developed an amazing capacity to interpret the Bible in an absolutely I mean, I don't know what language to use here, because there are all these different traditions within Christianity, but let's say if you used mere Christianity as a lens, because when Lewis wrote that book, he was trying to incorporate all of the different traditions of Christianity into this and looking at what are the common threads amongst all these traditions. And the LLM seems to be able to spring out a summary of the scriptures from beginning to end, together with the themes. And then when you drop a pebble in there and ask it, you know, well, like today I had this verse, 2 Corinthians 12:9, that I told you, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness, which made me think about God demonstrates his love for us in this. So I started by asking the LLM, are there places in the New Testament where love is defined so we can get a definition of love? And then I said, well, okay, I'm looking for a particular verse that has to do with God demonstrating his love, and it springs up Romans 5:8. And then I thought, I'm just going to see what happens. How would you see this relating to C.S. Lewis's essay Transposition? It just pops up this beautiful 5 points. You want to see it?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's see if we can find it here.
Have you already spoken with Annie, and I can't remember the other gentleman's name, about transposition?
No, not yet.
Okay, cool.
No, not yet. That's coming. Sorry, my screen is not acting properly here. Yeah. Grok is not
Is not grokking.
rocking right now.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out myself how deeply to interact with AI. I am becoming a little bit more interested in it, but I'm cautious about it and nervous.
Well, okay. I'm not trying to convince you of anything here because
Yeah, totally.
I don't want you
No,
to end up in a mess here because of me, but I do want to show you.
Okay, yeah, I see
Can
it.
you see
Yeah.
Grok here?
Yeah.
So C.S. Lewis's concept of transposition, and then he springs out these four things in which Romans 5:8 connects with them. So it's a higher reality in a lower medium. God's infinite, perfect love, the higher reality is demonstrated through the concrete historical act of Christ's death, the lower medium. The crucifixion, a brutal human event, becomes the vehicle for expressing divine love, suggesting that this earthly act is a shadow or echo of a greater eternal love we can only partially grasp, much like hearing a symphony through a single instrument.
Yeah, it's
Right?
that's pretty compelling. That,
And
yeah,
then love made
I gotta say,
tangible
right.
the paradox of sinners and sacrifice and experiential understanding. So, like anybody in the corner could have come up with these 4 points if we talked long enough, you know. But Grok is right there.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, but we get to participate in it. You know, Grok can just spit out the information.
Yes. Yeah.
We go on a journey to get there, which is much, yeah, different. And
But to me,
but yeah.
What's so fascinating about this is that maybe if somebody else asked the question a different way, Grok would have come up with an atheist perspective on this and torn the idea to shreds. I could probably do that too.
Oh yeah, that'd be interesting.
Right? But let's say that this is Grok's inner take on the meaning of
Oh,
this.
interesting.
That
Okay.
means that inside the data set of all human knowledge that's been gathered over all of history, which has in some sense been a transposition of the higher into the lower over all these centuries, albeit corrupted by sin, but still in there, this truth is available. And
Yeah.
this truth right here,
Yeah.
Capsulization of that. That's what's fascinating to me.
Oh yeah, wow, that's so fascinating. Yeah, I'm really very much I'm going to tune into that discussion you guys have. I think that's going to be so great. Annie is just
Okay, now.
such a gift, isn't she?
She certainly is. Now let's look at just this part right here. This is the summary that Grok made. In short, Romans 5:8 could be seen as a theological illustration of transposition. God's boundless love is transposed into the finite act of the cross, a medium we can witness and understand, yet one that invites us to imagine the greater symphony of divine affection behind it. Lewis might say that this demonstration is both the clearest note we have been given and a call to hear the fuller music it represents.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way to say it. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Okay, so now let's go to Bulverism.
Okay, yeah. This was surprising me. I was brushing up on this just this morning. It had been a while since I had listened to it or read Lewis's essay Bulverism, but the title, at least in the one that I listened to this morning, said something like Bulverism, or sometimes it was published as like an introduction to 20th century thought, or something to that. Because I was thinking it was, something pretty specific, and I've now, since encountering this essay, when I witness it, I can kind of smell it. When I see it, I know it. And so I've been able to, I think that's a fine way to say that. But I didn't realize kind of how grand of a statement it was in some sense. So one small way to understand it for those who haven't encountered it before, it's essentially when you are in an argument. So it's a type of logical fallacy, Lewis is claiming, where you attack someone's identity or motive rather than engaging with reasoning in their argument or with your argument itself. So,
Was a prophet, right?
yeah, I know. I mean, so Freud and Marx were, very much already a part of his time. And I think I really do think it is built into them. Freud is showing, here's our psychological motivations for things, and then, the materialist can kind of just say now, oh, that's all there is. All there is psychological motivations for things. And if we can show that someone has a certain psychological motivation, well, then we can, kind of pick apart everything, really. It really has no end. And then, yeah, Marx is the same with economics and class. If I can show this to have an economic or class motivation, or coming from a certain place in that class, he really just seemed to do two divides, the bourgeois, and then what am I forgetting? I don't
The
know.
proletariat.
Yeah. And so depending on where you are, you have these motivations, and then a lot of things play out. And it's, to give the devil his due, so to speak, very powerful arguments. You can explain, I will say, you can explain quite a lot of things with that theory. I think the problem is actually, though, still, it's still not a powerful enough theory in and of itself. Whereas, it tends to never look at itself, or it tends to never, critique itself by the same measure. And so there's kind of always this double standard. The psychologist, the one who's doing the psychologizing, never seems to turn and ask where's his psychology coming from? It's always this one way, kind of you're outside the frame looking in, and same with, it gives the economist, or kind of philosopher more in the Marx side of things, quite a lot of power, and rarely will it ever ask itself, where did that come from? And so yeah, it's amazing at how big of a, at how that has played out in people's minds and hearts. It's really quite scary, honestly. We are doing this to each other, many people, Christians alike. We are doing this to each other all the time by saying, oh, you just, Karen, you just invited me on your podcast because you are a boomer and you like to take advantage of millennials. And, that's what boomers
Wow.
do.
That's
Well,
what swimmers do.
I mean, it's funny because I'm so not serious, but it's amazing the things that people will put on someone with another identity and
Oh,
another
you can
name.
see comments like this. When I first
It's
started doing the channel, I'd have comments like this because for a while I was doing a series with Glenn, who is a genius in physics and mathematics and computer science. And people would make comments like, "Oh, these two old boomers are just lonely. They got to have something to do with their time,
totally,
right?"
totally. Yeah. No, that is bulverism. Yeah, too. And there's subtle forms of it. There's, I mean, yeah, there's grand forms of it. It is very, very pervasive. Yeah, much better to actually reason together. Although, you know, reasoning has some, and rationality has some limits as well. But at least let's not do this to each other. One of the things that I'm have been interested in recently in regards to this conversation is the claim that people are authoritarian. That's something. Well, it's very, I don't want to get over my head here in calling people Marxists or something like that. It's really above my pay grade. But what I do see happening is that claim that, oh, this is just a play for power. If we can show historically or sociologically, that's definitely a field where this seems to show up a lot. I'm sure you've noticed that over the years. Well, and you know, in that Hideous Strength, it's no coincidence that Mark is a sociologist. It seems to that seems to be a particularly a field where there's, you might say, quite a lot of temptation to make this move. If I can show with science that this group is authoritarian, well, I can really, you know, kind of debunk their claims. And so, yeah, that's one of the areas, you know, I think you were asking me about this because of a tweet that I a little spat that I was in, but I really do see, I really am quite frustrated by how we're doing this to each other, Christians alike. We just need to cut it out and engage with love and respect to each other. So
I
anyway,
mean,
I don't know how I did.
you've opened up a whole can of worms here that somebody should start a channel just about this subject because first of all, the thing with sociology is that was the turning point in our educational system was when we collapsed history and philosophy and certain kinds of science into a category called sociology and stopped teaching geography, stopped teaching history, stopped teaching these things as independent domains and collapsed it all into sociology, where then you could use science on all of these things. And to me, a perfect example of this, and Jordan Peterson, as much as I love him, he falls into this trap because
Yeah,
in
he
psychology, they
does.
use a lot of the same scientific, data gathering and all this. And
Yeah.
he talks a lot about this whole idea that conservatism is connected to disgust sensitivity because this is what science has shown through all these looking at all the personality types and
Yeah.
for certain personality type is closed-minded and they tend to be conservative. And so he's taken even though he himself tends to present he's not either really conservative or liberal, but he has some conservative tendencies, some liberal tendencies. But to use science to build these categories. So that's one aspect of this. The other aspect of
Yeah.
this is that I realized as you were talking, this fits in very well with what Ian McGilchrist calls nothing buttery. What's nothing but this or nothing but that?
Yes,
And
totally.
it makes a mockery of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that made me think of, well, nothing buttery is just a his pejorative term for reductionism. So then, in some sense, reductionism is a parallel to transposition.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I
But
can
then
see that.
reductionism would be sort of a false
A parody. Yeah.
transposition, a parody. It would be a parody of transposition, right?
Yeah, totally. Where something is reduced, but it doesn't aim back up. That might be one. It doesn't grow back up into love, into something else. It just
Hmm.
is like a I'm going to reduce you in order to stomp on you, or in order to show. Yeah, nothing buttery is a great. I'm definitely gonna steal that. If that's Ian's thing,
Yeah.
I'm gonna now make that my own. That's a great way to say that. I haven't heard that before. But yeah, because it yeah, the word just conservatism is just this psychological set of effects, and it can be related, or that, I mean, that's interesting to say how it's related, or here's a pattern that I've noticed, but
And
and then we can
once
have.
they identify that pattern, then they can identify you with the other person who had that pattern. And guess who had the pattern of disgust sensitivity? And I won't say his name because then we'll get a strike on X, but he lived, in the 1930s and 40s, and his name started with H. So then
Here
you
we
can
are.
paint everybody with a broad brush,
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and really, what does disgust sensitivity mean? You could unpack that for a long time and find out that there are many, many layers of disgust sensitivity that aren't just flaring your nostrils and being,
Yeah.
disgusted with people. There's
Yeah.
many levels to all these things. Once you start simplifying it down in order to make it nothing but, then you've lost the thread completely.
Right. And yeah, maybe this will be a good place to end, because I can kind of see a bow kind of coming on this. It again, it has to do with how we were made, and if we were made for something, for goodness, for beauty, for truth, for love. If that is the case, then just something like disgust could be an absolutely appropriate. If something is not one of those things, I see no reason why it can't go in the disgust bucket, if it's appropriately so. And that's what is the interesting now conversation, is what types of things are praiseworthy, what types of things are not praiseworthy. If the Lord has made us with senses to if we can, the hymn puts it, if we can tune our hearts, then to God's, what he wants us to see and know, there is room for disgust. For I mean, there's so much room, but it must be from him, and because we were made that way, because we were to know him. That's a claim that I want to, really stick to, and make sure I'm believing, and not contradicting that I was made for him.
That's so perfect because we have to have that radar, because in Proverbs, where it talks about wisdom, what the father says, son, be careful, because wisdom sits on the hill and wisdom says, come in here. But the other kind of woman also sits on the hill and says, come in here. Folly, wisdom says, come in here. Folly says, come in here. If you don't have a disgust meter that tells you which of those come in hears is the right voice. Jesus says, they will know my voice. My sheep will know my voice and they will listen to me. So we have to have some kind of a disgust meter that says, no, that way leads to sin and destruction. This other way leads to life, right?
Totally agree. And so yeah, when we see bulverism, we can have disgust. It's allowed.
Yeah. Well, this was great. I'm excited about your new podcast, the Transposition Podcast, being brought to you by Brantley Bosler.
Yeah.
I look forward to hearing more from you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Karen. This is really life-giving for me, and hopefully we can do it again sometime. I'll have you
Absolutely.
on my channel.
That would be great. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.